It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff and Gina are here, joined by Matthew Ingram from Giga Ohm. We're going to talk about the new Motorola phones, the new Nokia phones, the stock market's disappointing reaction to the Nokia phones, and maybe a 3G Nexus 7. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 162, recorded September 5th, 2012. The RTFM tax. This Week in Google is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, visit Stamps.com, click the radio microphone, and use the promo code TWIG. And by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at Ting.com/TWIG. Are you ready? Well, this is Twig, This Week in Giggle. I'm going to call it that because people got mad at us last week because we didn't talk about Google enough. So it's This Week in Giggle. But it could be about Google, the cloud, anything that Jeff and Gina want to talk about, basically. Gina Trapani is here, smarterware.org, ThinkUp app.
An expert giggler.
She knows all about giggling.
I do. I practice giggling. I do.
I'll giggle. You and I both like to laugh.
We do.
I think that's good. Now,
don't
Jeff.
Notice he left me out of it.
Jeff is not a big laugher.
Wow.
Jeff, you don't laugh a lot. You scowl, you grimace.
Jeff is rage face of the group.
Now, Jeff Jarvis, a jolly old elf. He is a professor of journalism at the City University of New York, the author of Public Parts, great book about living in public. And both Jeff and Gina are our regular hosts joining us this week. From Giga Ohm, Matthew Ingram is here, senior editor at Giga Ohm. It's good to see you, Matthew.
Hi.
Welcome. Where are you based?
Toronto.
Another Canadian. I like it.
We're everywhere.
Yeah, I like it. We have more Canadians on this network, and it's not by choice. It's just it happens that we do. I don't know why that is.
They're nice people.
They're nice.
Nice people like nice people.
They're nice people.
There you go. We're nice.
Now, Matthew covers the internet. Doesn't cover anything that you breaks when you drop it. But we are going to cover something that breaks when you drop it. So your opinion is welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
Because there's a new droid in town. Actually, I should probably start with the kind of interesting news that Google is activating. Let me see if I can get. This is from Eric Schmidt, ever the leaky sieve. Who says that this is at the Motorola On Display event. I think the most interesting thing announced at that event, is this your number, Jeff? I hope I'm not.
Nope.
1.3 million Android devices are activated every day. Of that number, 70,000 are tablets, which is a pretty hefty number. That's 210,000 tablets a month. That's decent. And it's up considerably from last December, it was 700,000.
I just saw a figure somewhere. I didn't save it, unfortunately, but in some market, I think it is, maybe here, the Samsung was outselling the iPhone, Samsung S3.
That's correct. But that, I think, is not to be given too much credit because...
given the timing of the iPhone.
Yeah, the new iPhone comes out next month. The consumers are actually smarter than some people give them credit for and are absolutely not buying the iPhone because they're waiting and see. Whereas the Samsung Galaxy S3, which did in fact for the first time last month,
could be buy the S3 while you can, since it's got added to the Apple suit.
Well, we saw it's interesting because we saw a variety of. Did I get the number of tablets wrong? 70,000 a day times 30. 200 isn't that 210,000 tablets a month? Am I wrong? No, it's 2.1 million tablets a month. I am wrong.
That sounds better.
That's a lot of tablets. Yeah. I did. That sounded like too big a number
here.
Wow, 2.1 million tablets a month. Android tablets. Most of those have to be Kindles.
I love mine.
I'm not Kindles, that one. Nexus 7s.
The Nexus 7.
Yeah.
Don't ask me about numbers today. I'm not good, apparently. So Motorola, at the same event, announced the new Motorola Razr family, the Droid Razr Ultra Thin, the Droid Razr Max. Those have already been out for a while. Now the Droid Razr Max HD and the Droid Razr HD. Basically, bigger, crisper displays, longer battery life, an incremental improvement.
Didn't they have the Droid and they had the Razr and now it's the Droid Razr? The Razr was kind of the old-fashioned phone?
Yes. They took the name Razr from the old Razr and put it on Droid.
I'll get it.
Because it was such a successful phone, the Razr.
Well, it was for a while.
Yeah.
Well, like forever ago, though. They need to ditch both those names and come up with something
Droid
new.
Droid is a terrible name.
Yeah.
R-A-Z-R is a terrible name. So 4.7-inch... 1280 by 768 display. This is the Verizon flagship phone, but I have to say, I don't think these are that impressive. 1.5 gigahertz Snapdragon, gigabyte of RAM, ice cream sandwich, but they will be upgraded to Jelly Bean by the end of the year.
They're LTE. Shipping with ICS.
Yeah, shipping
that's
with
so
ICS.
Amazing. It's a Google company and they can't get their act together.
That's a good example of what the hell. Motorola's stopped doing so much blur. We reviewed yesterday and before you buy, we reviewed a new Motorola phone for Sprint? I can't remember, but it's not very blurry. It is pretty much a vanilla Google experience. So at least they're moving in that direction. Big batteries on these guys. Big, I think probably biggest in class. The Razr HD, 2530 milliamp hours. The Max HD, 3300 milliamp hours. That's, I think, even bigger than the Note 2. So they say 27 hours streaming music, 10 hours streaming video, 32 hours mixed use time, 21 hours talk time.
I saw that the latest iPhone rumor is that the Apple iPhone battery will be 40% bigger and Mondo battery. So I think we're in battery battles now, which is not a bad thing.
We ought to be.
For any of us.
Yeah, we should be.
Yeah, we ought to be. Although again, it's all rumors. We won't know till next Wednesday. But the rumored size of that battery is not big. I think it was 1,750 milliamp hours. Not big compared to the big app batteries we're seeing on Android. It is, but what we're trying to do is get a phone that'll last till we go to bed.
Yeah.
We're not asking much.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to last all week, just till we go to bed. And I have yet to find a good phone that'll do that. The Nokia announcement today, this is announcement week. Tomorrow will be Amazon's announcements. We'll get that in a second. Nokia announced two new Windows 8 phones, the Lumia 820 and the Lumia 920. I think the thing most interesting about the Lumia 920, the top of the line, besides the fact that it's running the new Windows 8 operating system, Windows 8 phone, is that it's going to use a PureView camera. This camera is similar to the 41 megapixel camera that they're shipping in a Symbian-based phone. But it has it apparently good low light, more than 8 megapixels, a lot of capability. If it lives up to its promise, it probably will be the best camera phone out there. Is that enough, though, to get people to buy it? I don't know.
And where do you go? Do you buy that or do you buy the phone camera?
The
cameras with Android on them.
Right. That's kind of interesting, too, isn't it?
Nokia, what's the biggest... Is it the biggest company that went from number one in a technology field to near death?
Well, I think there's a long history of companies. IBM was pretty big at one time. Not near death at any point.
But didn't really go near death.
Apple certainly got close to dying. 90 days of dying.
It did, but it wasn't number one. Not by a long shot.
No, it's a pretty big fall.
Big fall. But I just think that from being in such an enviable, wonderful position... to such a low position in such a fast period.
Which is probably...
I think RIM is going there, though, isn't it?
Say again?
Who?
I think RIM is going there, though, isn't it?
RIM is, too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Very similar.
Sorry, Canadian.
Kodak? No, I don't think Kodak counts.
No?
No.
I think that really what happened to Nokia was the rise of the smartphone And ironically, Nokia was one of the first companies to do smartphones based on, first on Symbian, and then they had Mimo and Migo.
Yeah, the Nokia Symbian phone was my first smartphone.
Yep.
I was Moblog and a Flickr with that.
Yeah. Text America, baby.
Good times.
The N95.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah, I think it was the N95.
It looked like a camcorder. Actually, I have an N95 in my museum behind me. I loved that N95. That was an awesome little phone. Mobloggin'.
Mobloggin'.
That was the Scoble special.
Yes. I first saw it at a podcast expo many years ago because I think it was Chris Marquardt was interviewing people, or maybe it was Father Roderick was interviewing people with his N95. Yeah, Scoble loved it. So that's a really interesting situation where a company was totally dominant. And by the way, they still are. They even then they were known for the best cameras, weren't they?
Yeah.
But it's over. And Motorola, apparently Google's selling off the set-top box division. I wonder, this Motorola acquisition, Google does not seem to have taken it in hand very well. No, these are not impressive phones. They're real also-rans. They should be. Shouldn't they be doing the Google Experience phone from Motorola? When's that?
Yes.
Wasn't there a quote today? Someone said, and I couldn't find it again. I saw it run by on Twitter that somebody said, and so I could be wrong here. It was very hearsay-ish, that if you want a great Android phone, buy Motorola. And somebody else said, well, gee, what a Samsung, and think of that.
It's not true. Samsung is the Android phone to buy. And I think HTC. Now, HTC, of all of the companies, decided to wait till after Apple's announcement. We'll see how that strategy works.
It could be like the days when we had newspaper and magazine. We had magazine covers, and we'd make five or six of them and leave them by the press and decide which one to put on.
Oh, you think?
Maybe they have different products ready to throw out. I don't know.
You think? Yeah. Throw out that one. Okay, that one is out. We don't want to get sued over there. You think it's worried about getting sued or not, or being buried in the marketplace?
Both.
Yeah. it's just surprising that Motorola. Well, is it too soon to say this is the new Google Rolla?
Yeah,
maybe right this cycle. Maybe next year, this time they'll have finally. Still, it seems like they could have coordinated a little bit to ship with Jelly Bean.
The transaction closed in May, so May, June. That was pretty fast to do it in 3 or 4 months. Is pretty fast.
They're selling off the set-top box business, so there goes our sort of Google TV.
I know. We had a whole whole strategy planned.
We did. They wouldn't listen to us. Fools.
They didn't listen.
We knew what to do. Dennis Woods.
As you said last week, you still argued, Leo, last week, as I remember, that there will be no set-top boxes, so why be in that business at all?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bad business. It's gone the way of the queue. Google... Executive Dennis Woodside became Motorola's new leader. He said on yesterday, the merging of Motorola and Google will take mobile innovation to new heights. I hope you okay. We have
versus what?
The Droid Razr HD is not new heights. It's not new heights. I'm sorry.
It's priced at, $100, I think, for Verizon.
You know, I don't even know why people bother talking about handset prices. I guess consumers pay attention. Have they not learned that really that's a fraction of the total cost of the phone, that it's the monthly fee that really makes the difference? Maybe not. Anyway, Nokia's stock price tumbling 13% as a result of their lackluster announcement. $99 for the Razr M. What's the M? I don't know what that is.
So basically, phones made in cold places are headed down. Phones made in hot places are headed up.
Ah, I think you've discovered a trend.
You've put your finger on it.
Always get
it's a conspiracy.
The southernmost phone.
The great Robertson Davies said that Canada was not like America. It was like Scandinavia. So the Nokia rim axis here is falling.
Really? He said it was Scandinavia. Huh?
Yeah.
It is kind of like Scandinavia.
It is. He argued culturally it was closer to Scandinavia.
Lots of fish.
Beer.
Just a quiet attitude.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Sled dogs.
You could do worse than being like Norway, now the number two richest nation in the world.
Yeah.
Thanks to their oil reserves.
Nokia's down 16% now.
Oy! Oof. So that's an example of what, buying on the rumor, selling on the news. The news was not enough to get the stock market excited.
No.
Shares of Finnish handset maker drop after company unveils two new flagship devices in make-or-break move. According to the Wall Street Journal, it was a make-or-break event.
Yeah, this chart, this is an epic cliff.
Yikes. Yeah. Investors want to be sure the devices will be selling well ahead of Christmas. For Nokia, it's all about distribution now, and we got no answers on when these new devices will sell, and which U.S. market operators will market them. So that's key. These are Christmas devices, but they don't have any deals.
Nokia's always, go back to your N95, they've always had problems doing deals with the phone companies.
A lot of experts think that that's actually what happened. It wasn't, it was just merely that they did not have the U.S. deals, and so they were selling unlocked phone in the U.S., and nobody was interested.
Yeah.
That was an analyst at the Swedish banking group, Swedbank.
I think it's 60% of its value in the last year.
We're gonna have an interesting fellow on Triangulation next week, not today, but a week from today. Hans-Peter Brondmo, who I met in Norway at the Nordic Light Festival. He does something interesting for Nokia. He's a startup guy, and the idea was that Nokia brought him in to fund internal development as if they were startups. So if you've got an idea and you're a Nokia employee and you've got an idea, you go to Hans and say, look, I want to create a Skunkworks. I want funding as if it's a startup. They have startup metrics. You have to show a certain amount of growth, et cetera, et cetera. The idea being to bring this kind of innovation into a company. I think it's a very interesting idea.
A lot of big companies try to do that, right? Like Microsoft kind of does that a little bit. Google did that
certainly
with Wave.
Does.
That's how Wave was structured. I wonder if you can have the kind of urgency that an actual startup founder has around like whether or not they're going to be able to pay the bills, you know, inside a big company.
You
like
can't
that.
Unless your job is on the line, right? And I don't think they want to go that far.
But you have access to resources that you might not otherwise.
That's the key, I think, for him is, yeah. And also the accountability. So you're accountable to, you know, these metrics. You have to produce like a startup would have to produce.
Well, but do you get the upside? Is the problem?
No.
And you don't? And,
well, I don't
and
know, maybe.
You still know that there's corporate politics there. Yeah. Yeah, you can do phantom equity. When I started Entertainment Weekly, we were called entrepreneurial because this is God's honest truth. We were outside the Time Life building one block away, and that was considered really great.
If you had only raised a pirate flag to the roof.
Yeah, they regretted not having me close under their thumb. And then we got phantom equity, which turned out to be quite a phantom in most ways. Because the accounting is always, it's like Hollywood accounting.
Yeah.
Well, no, we got a charger for the desks.
Phantom equity. Yeah, I had phantom equity at Tech TV. and you were just the same. It was completely phantom. Because it turned out that Paul Allen had to be made whole before we did. And by the time he got his money, it was like there's nothing left for anybody else. We're going to work on getting Matthew back. We've lost his signal. You know, Rogers does this in Canada. They just, if they see you using Skype, after 15 minutes, they go, you're done. You can't, no, you, no call should last more than 15 minutes.
Those Canadians, they're not so nice. They only seem like they're nice.
Mr. Rogers is not so nice. Are you on Rogers? What are you on, Matthew?
Yeah, Rogers.
Yeah. See, I knew it.
Is there anything
I'm
else?
I'm contractually obligated to say that Ted Rogers is a wonderful man and tremendous service.
Ted Rogers is the Rupert Murdoch of Canada, which is the Norway of the North America. So it's very confusing.
I thought we were Finland.
Are you Finland? No, Finland's not part of Scandinavia. Finland is just completely different.
It's its own thing.
It's its own thing. Mm. It's more Russian than Scandinavian, I'm told. We're going to take a break. We got Matthew back, but I'm still going to take a break. So there. This portion of the show brought to you by our friends at Stamps.com. Stamps.com lets you print U.S. postage. I know that seems like that should be illegal somehow, but it isn't. In fact, the Postal Service loves it because you never have to darken their door again. You can stay at your desk and print your own postage, mail your own stuff. You can actually do stuff. Everything you could do at the post office, you could do at Stamps.com. For instance, give me one. International mailing. Good example. Used to be, if you want to send something overseas, you'd have to go into the post office, and there's forms and all this stuff, and get an international mailing thing. No, stamps.com, they'll do it. They even fill out the forms for you. I got one. Packages bigger than 13 ounces. I've actually mailed, you know, books that weigh 2 pounds. You get them back. The post and the mailman says, you got to go to the post office because we got to look at you in the eye in this post 911 era. Not with stamps.com. No limit to the size of the packages you mail. You get discounts you can't even get at the post office, up to 21% on express mail, up to 15% on priority mail. I mean, it's really cool. Now, here's the deal. I want you to try this. So we got this no-risk trial offer. When you go to stamps.com, do you see it right there? And that seems pretty tempting, $80 value. Do not click that. They're not going to like. Stamps is going to be mad at me for saying that. But click the microphone and enter the word TWIG in the promo code, TWIG. And then it's a $110 bonus offer. So what they do is they increase the postage coupons you get. Coupons for up to $55 in postage. You use them over a period of time. It's not all at once. But, hey, it's a $55 free postage. That's nothing to sneeze at. And you get the digital scale for free. You pay shipping and handling for that. That's $5. To pay you back on that, they give you a $5 supply kit and a four-week trial. So you're making out like a bandit here. This is a 30-day no-risk trial. All you have to do is go to stamps.com and use the promo code TWIG. It's worth $110. And you'll see why I love stamps.com. We have two accounts here. I love stamps.com, and you will love it too, because you just don't have to go to the post office. The mail carrier comes to you. Stamps.com. So let's move on from Motorola. Apparently, Google is, according to rumor, going to release a Nexus 7 with 3G in it in the next 6 weeks. This comes from the Next Web. Actually, Motico, Paul O'Brien at Motico, had the original story. So let's give Paul credit here. That would be... Now, the problem is that this is going to be a tough market because... Not only are you going to see Amazon, I think, tomorrow announce new Kindle Fires. We're sure of that, right? Because they sold out on Amazon.com. But in a week or maybe next month, depending on who you believe, Apple's going to announce a mini iPad in this market. So,
The report on Amazon is it's going to be ad-supported. So they're going to break even the $200 line that Google set. So we see this incredible... lowering, and what does Apple do in that case? Apple doesn't go for, you know, price shrinkage. How is it going to be so special that it's worth, you know, what, $400 at a 7-inch?
It won't be. I'm convinced that Apple, here's my reason I think this. And I've seen a number of blogs that say really the mini iPad is an iPad 2 in terms of internals. It's 1024x768. It's a smaller screen with that resolution, but that's the iPad 2 resolution. Same chip in there. This is, in other words, this is last year's technology. And it, based on pricing, it is possible that Apple could actually sell this at $200.
Really?
Now, the advantage, of course, Amazon has is, first of all, Apple was not going to do an ad-supported device. And Amazon's real purpose for the Kindle Fire is to get you to buy stuff from Amazon.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think machine.
Apple's always said, we don't even make it money on iTunes. You know? Apple makes money on hardware. So can... But on the other hand, if they sell it for $400, it's a non-starter, isn't it?
I think so.
What's the price?
It's
in a world. You wanted me, Matthew Ingram, to do in a world.
Before time.
In a world where Amazon is selling a tablet for $150. In a world where Google is selling a $200 tablet, can Apple sell what? $250? I think they could sell $250.
You know, Farhad, I think it was Farhad at...
Farhad Manju?
Is he at Slate?
Yep.
Yeah. He had a thing arguing that the Kindle wants to be free. And I think if you look at what Amazon does, I mean, Amazon makes money on content, selling content, right? They don't care about the hardware. Apple's the exact opposite.
I love this. The Kindle, like information, the Kindle wants to be free. This is actually in the Daily Herald. Wow. My record, says Farhad, on the about Amazon's mixed at best. 2 summers ago, I guess that before the holidays, Amazon would cut the price of its cheapest Kindle to $99. They did eventually, but just did, they didn't do it until this year, or last year, I guess, with a $79 ad-supported Kindle. I don't know about free. How
but
much
close to free, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
subsidized for sure, right?
$50.
But it, but even at $200, it was subsidized.
All right. So,
but
so
the point is,
you
Amazon
said before
doesn't
about
care
phones.
About the hardware price.
Right.
That's not what they're
you said before about phones that you know, everybody knows the price isn't the price. So the same will be here. It's just subsidized a different way. If you buy enough stuff, if you join Prime, if you blah, 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 blah,
yeah.
blah, then you get a free device. The device costs you nothing because.
I think Scobel said that. I think Scobel thought that the Fire would be free with a Prime subscription.
Yeah.
Before it came out.
Maybe there's Prime Plus or something.
And you have to imagine that they're giving you a cash register. I mean, that's what you have to think about it. You have to think about, like, this is a way for them to get money out of me.
Right.
I mean, I hate to be that cynical. And I love the Nexus 7, and I really love the Kindle as well. But they're just giving you a cash register for you to perform transactions with them.
It's a tube they can dump content through.
But the key here is that we've talked about, you've talked about this before, guys, that the Kindle was a emasculated, pardon me if that's sexist, but a gutted Android. Right,
and it was terrible
features, and it was bad.
And that's why the Nexus. I'm convinced that's why the Nexus 7 was so popular. Same price, and it's really Android. In fact, it's better. It's Jelly Bean.
Right. So what does that do to Amazon? Now, Amazon surely is watching that and saying this thing is actually good. Jelly Bean's actually good. We're not really hurt horribly if we put some of those features in there. We've got to have those computer like functions of mapping and all that kind of stuff and communication and email. Does Kindle move beyond being just a content device to truly becoming a tablet computer, or does it stay as a content conduit?
And will people be satisfied with something that's just a big iPod as opposed to an iPad?
Yeah.
Because the iPad's definitely moved into the content creation sphere. It's a laptop, really.
Meanwhile, what happens to Barnes & Noble's and then also in Canada, the Kobo?
Mm-hmm. Dead.
What's
dead?
Yeah, it's dead. Who would? Why bother?
Yeah.
And in fact, what's really interesting, this is so different from the PC marketplace where you could have numerous incumbents. What this feels like in the tablet market is really there can only be one, maybe two. Why is that? Is that because it's a new market? Will that shake out? I mean, when IBM made the PC, it was just IBM. Then it was IBM and Compaq. Then it was IBM and a jillion other companies. Maybe that's what's going on with tablets. Or is it really the case that right now there's only two? There's an iPad or there's a Nexus 7 and that's it.
There's only two phone operating systems. We just went through that, right?
Yeah, but there are multiple hardware choices from multiple manufacturers. It doesn't look like that. The cliff falls off. You've got iPad at the top. Pretty far below that, you've got the Nexus 7. Pretty far below that, almost to zero, you've got the Kindle Fire, and then there's nothing.
You've got the Samsung 10-inch with the writing thing and all that. That's niche.
I don't know. I don't know how well those sell. What did he say? 70,000 a day, 2.1 million a month. I find that hard to believe that they're activating 2.1 million tablets a month.
Do you think he's including Kindle in that?
Yeah, I wonder if he's including Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
That number seems way high.
It just seems huge.
Yeah, didn't they sell like 8 million Nexus 7s, which was way more than they projected? I thought I saw that number somewhere. So, and the Nexus 7 has been out for...
Well, that's about right.
Months.
Just a few months. So it must be. It's mostly Nexus 7s.
Mostly Nexus 7s?
Wow.
The Nexus 7 is pretty great. I mean, the thing that makes the Nexus 7 so great is the Google layer for me.
Right,
because I use Calendar and I use Maps and I use Gmail and I use Google Voice and I want all those things. I mean, I want those things on my tablet, right? And you can't. And honestly, like, I love the market, the Play Store. I think the Play Store is better. Well, let's say this. I think the Play Store, the app situation in the Play Store is much better than Amazon's App Store.
From the developer's point of view or the buyer's point of view?
Both. I'd argue both.
What's better about it?
Content-wise, Amazon has way better content.
Why people would? I see. Better than the Play Store.
Yeah. So I think that the experience of buying apps on the Play Store is better. Although maybe I should make this argument because I don't have a Kindle. I haven't installed the Amazon App Store.
I have, I find it a very weak experience.
Yeah.
It's the only advantage they have is the free app of the day, but it's usually crap.
Right. Yeah. Right. So the Play Store experience is better for the buyer, and it's way better for the developer, for sure. I mean, the Amazon App Store, you just have to wait for approval, and you don't have control over your copy, and it, right. you know, it's just, it's difficult. They just haven't developed, the tools just aren't mature. They aren't as mature, because they just haven't been around as long.
And you know, it seems little thing, but I have to say, I love web install.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems like a little thing.
But I love it too.
Great.
Okay, maybe it's not just me.
No, the Megillah you have to go through with Apple of downloading it and syncing and all that mess and upgrading things, I think that it is a step stage ahead as an experience, as an ongoing, you know, consumer experience.
It's too bad.
Gene, I'm curious.
Go ahead.
Would you, if given the choice now, would you buy this with 3G?
Yeah, I think I would buy it with 3G, I have to say.
Too. So yeah, it's too geeky to use your phone in tether mode? And the Wi-Fi and the
pain.
7.
It takes time.
It's a pain.
Because you got to fire it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a pain.
So it really is it's a demerit not to have 3G.
It is. And, you know, so. the commercials where the dad and the son are camping
that
in the backyard.
That was dumb.
I mean, that was just, I was such a, I feel like it's like they couldn't have picked a commercial that highlights the fact that you have to be on Wi-Fi more to the people who know that you'd have to be on Wi-Fi. It just seemed like a crazy choice of campaign. But yeah, I mean, this seems obvious that they come out with a 3G version before the holiday season. Didn't somebody do a teardown and you could see where the 3G bits and pieces would go? I think it's going to sell well. I mean, I don't know. The people who already have a Nexus 7, I don't know if they're going to buy the 3G version, but for the people who are serious tablet users who are going to be out and about, I think a 3G version is a good value, good offer.
Hmm. Well, it's coming, they say, or somebody says, Modica says, soon. You're watching the convention, you watch the Republican convention, the Democratic convention. YouTube's very involved with both. They're streaming a lot of it, although... apparently, YouTube flagged the Democratic convention video on copyright grounds.
I mean, at this point, like, isn't it so clear that these copyright bots are just so badly implemented?
It's terrible.
It's a high-profile situations where things get pulled down. I mean, Leo, you deal with this pain every day in your day-to-day business, but... Man.
Well, and I've been complaining about it, but maybe now. So the Hugo Awards got pulled down by Ustream for the same thing.
Unbelievable.
They were showing clips of Hugo-nominated movies, and the automated copyright bots saw it and disconnected it on Ustream. So the live stream of the Hugo, the big science fiction awards.
Right in the middle
of it.
Yeah.
First Lady Michelle Obama's speech live streamed on YouTube. But then immediately after it finished, it was flagged by copyright claims from WMG, SME, Associated Press, UMG, Dow Jones, New York Times, Harry Fox Agency, Warner Chappell, UMPG Publishing, and EMI Music.
Who should we be mad about this to? Is it YouTube? Is it the companies that supposedly complain through their bots? Is it the whole damn copyright system? Is it
all
the pirates who caused this? I vote A, B, C.
E, all of the above.
It's just terrible.
I'm mostly mad at Google for not writing a better bot. But also for not pushing back on these people and saying, you know.
Well, they've got to do a whitelist. They've got a whitelist.
They do.
To say that we understand that you know what you're doing. And if you don't, if you mess it up, you're going to go into the into Shea Woodshed here. But for God's sakes, Twit is a professional organization. It's not in your interest to get sued. It's not in your interest to get in trouble with Google. They should have a whitelist for you and the Democratic National Committee.
Look at this. The video is still blocked.
Mm-hmm.
The DNC has made the video private because it's embarrassing. That's just wrong.
You know what concerns me is... Google says that it's going to voluntarily push down websites' page rank based on copyright claims. What concerns me is we're going to have the same type of bogus claim, except they're going to affect website page rank, and you're not even going to know about it.
This is
but it's one factor, and any system can indeed get scammed, can get gamed. And so, it will get gamed. You're absolutely right, Matthew, you will. But then I think Google will suffer from that, and then they'll fix it.
But here we see the message, right? We're outraged because we see a message saying it's been blocked. We're never going to know whether a site should be higher in page rank or should be lower. It's just going to happen.
But the sites that are involved, the sites that are affected by it will know, and they'll, like if it happens to Twit, Twit's going to put up a fit, properly so, and we, the Twit Army, will come in their defense and storm Mountain View with pitchforks and torches. Yes.
Clearly it's an, I mean, look at the list of people who are complaining about it. It's, I don't even, the Associated Press, the New York Times, surely the New York Times isn't asserting that they have a copyright on Michelle Obama's speech.
No, wasn't there some, wasn't it the video that was blocked?
It was the video. Clips?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so there's some automated thing that says there's an, I presume this is what happened. There's an ID for the AP or the New York Times and something. Yeah. And it just, and they have their own bots. And so the, it's a complaint bot meets the copyright bot. And
right. I think this is even worse. I think this is something that we've seen frequently where it's reversed. So the New York Times or Fox or Harry Fox Agency or somebody was playing the speech and they asserted a copyright on their news story with the speech in. We've seen this happen many times where local news does a takedown. This happened to the NASA Curiosity landing, which is NASA uncopyrighted material that every local news station ran. And then the bots said, oh, it was on the local news. So actually the local news owned the NASA footage. So they killed the NASA video.
I see.
I wonder if this is that.
Yeah, no, I'll bet you're right then. Okay, I bet they're right.
Because I watched that video.
Not Hugo. Hugo was clips from...
Clips.
Right.
It's just a mess. And it's embarrassing to YouTube because YouTube is the official streaming partner of both the Republican and the Democratic conventions.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
It's pretty dumb.
This is where the white... Somebody's got to build a whitelist functionality to say our friends don't get screwed.
And it's...
our friends are innocent until proven guilty. Like, there's, you know, that
exactly.
Like...
Right.
I think they can't.
Give them the benefit of the doubt.
I think they can't.
Why not?
Why?
I think they're worried about losing their safe harbor, so they bend over backwards. Because the worst thing that could happen to YouTube is to be seen as a publisher, not as a safe harbor protected. So if
they start favoring certain people,
then they're partisan.
I think they're making an active choice.
I think their lawyers are saying, no, dudes, don't do that. The worst, because it would put YouTube out of business if it were.
So this is just collateral damage.
It's collateral damage to the DMCA.
Well, it's dumb.
It's dumb.
This story from Wired.com says it was Michelle Obama's speech.
YouTube says it just briefly showed an incorrect error message, but the reality is the video was blocked for hours.
Yeah, YouTube got it all wrong, because YouTube's statement was after tonight's live stream ended, YouTube briefly showed an incorrect error message. Neither the live stream nor any of the channel's videos were affected. But according to Wired.com, it's not clear what he meant by none of the channel's videos were affected, as the video was unplayable.
That's pretty affected.
What's funny is that when contacted by Wired for comment late Tuesday, an Obama campaign staffer who works on digital outreach had no knowledge of the outage, asked the reporter for the URL, and then upon seeing the takedown said, I'll have to call you back. That's straight out of an Aaron Sorkin script.
That poor guy.
Well, to be fair, they were kind of busy yesterday.
Yeah.
You see two things happening here at cross purposes, because you see these absurd extensions of copyright. We haven't even gotten to my friends in Germany and France yet. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have Canada. Since we have Matthew here, let's honor Canada. Canada has a new copyright law that extends fair use, or what is it, fair gizm or something? What do you call it here? Fair dealing, yeah. Matthew, do you know what the law? Can you describe some of the new features?
I can't go into it in any detail. I haven't looked.
We'll have to get Michael Geist to explain it all.
I'll just go look at his website.
It's interesting because there's what The Economist wrote about this, that there's a whole bunch of new efforts to soften or make more sense out. Let's say it makes more sense out of copyright in a few countries, yet at the same time, of course, we have insanity going on.
Well, we keep saying it's the pendulum, right, swinging, except the pendulum seems to be stuck. I think it hit really hard on one side and it got stuck because it hasn't swung in any appreciable way in the last as long as I've been around. How long is copyright now for? Forever!
Oh. All right, here it is. Canada passed a law in June that sets a new standard of permissiveness. It caps statutory damages if copyright is breached for non-commercial purposes. That's a big F. It expands definition of fair dealing, fair use in America. Fair dinkum, as I'm sure what it'll be called in Australia. And creates exemptions for educational purposes and for parody. Firms will pass warnings about infringement to the person who posted the material rather than immediately take the content down themselves. This contrasts with the practice in America and Europe where a web company alerted to infringing material must remove it. This encourages knee-jerk responses to complaints. Here I'm quoting from The Economist, folks. Britain, too, plans to introduce internet-friendly legislation this autumn after a review by Ian Hargreaves. It'll also recommend exemptions for non-commercial use, user-generated content, and so on. Another innovation is an exemption for copies engaged in text and data mining, known as big data. So the idea that if you copied something only to analyze it, you were creating a copyright violation is absurd. You're now allowed under this notion here, not spread widely, but I think in Ireland and Australia, that you can analyze the data, which advances knowledge and science and such and so forth. But as The Economist says, the tide is not all one way. EU officials want to maintain rules whereby computer users pay a small tithe on digital products to collection societies. These fees are meant to go to content creators. Meanwhile, my friends, the Germans, I just met with one today, who have their Leistungsschutzrecht, which is we talked about this show before, the effort to extend copyright to make Google pay for snippets. Now France, of course, is proposing the same thing through magazine publishers there. That pendulum ain't coming back.
So I just went to the Barack Obama site, and the day two is now up. So YouTube has either unblocked it or something. But it's looked like it was blocked for quite some time. So
is that the live stream or is that?
You're right. This is now.
Yeah, that's the live stream. Yeah.
Oh, never mind. Day two. This is day. All right. Well, you should have just watched it on TV anyway. That YouTube's stupid. Okay. Who watches TV on YouTube anyway? Silly.
Who watches
idea.
Video on the web?
It's for crotch shots. Come on. Let's get it right.
Never take off.
And Lady Gaga videos. That's what YouTube's for. Not politics. Actually, it really is a problem if they want to make YouTube, you know, credible and reliable for news. They got to solve that.
Yep.
What happens, NPR asks, when a Kickstarter campaign fails? Does anyone get their money back? No. The answer.
Maybe.
Really?
Well, if it doesn't get funded, you get your money back. You never get
You charged. Never paid money, but... But I have to say, I'm looking at all the stuff I've spent money on Kickstarter, and the only thing I ever got was a bra. So,
was it a man's ear?
Well, no, it's called the Joey bra, and the idea was it was like a kangaroo, as a baby kangaroo, right. It's called a Joey. Right. It was a bra with a pouch for your iPhone.
Did you try it?
It was too small. So I got something, but it was too small. So I've backed eight projects. All of these I've paid for, except for one, the space folk album, the folk album on the moon, did not get funded. But everything else here got funded, included Diaspora, the Pebble Watch, the Cone coffee filter.
I just got the email telling me to put the address in for the Pebble Watch.
I've gotten all that crap too. None of this have I received.
I've got a different problem, Leo. I've gotten everything, but I have real buyer's remorse. Right?
Yeah, me too.
I got a little thing that revolutionizes video on the iPhone, and it's this little plastic thing that fits over the camera so that you can just put it down and it'll take a picture with a And I thought, why did I buy that? What?
Now, how much was that?
Oh, I think it was like, you know, $6, but it was, why did I do that? The worst one was, and you made fun of me for this already, but it's an iPhone case that magically copies basically all my credit cards and frequent shopper cards in the case.
That's a good
in
idea.
One card, so I can just use that card.
Yeah.
But it's a case. I don't want another case for my iPhone, A. And I now have this thing. I should sell it on eBay. And B, I can imagine going to the store and saying, no, really, that's an American Express card. So,
right.
Yeah, that's my problem is I buy stupid stuff.
Well, I don't know if this is stupid or not, but I haven't gotten it. Go ahead, Matthew. Sorry.
So Kickstarter is the new home shopping network.
Yeah.
You just stay up late.
Look what I bought.
There you go. Matthew, that's it.
Look at the crap I purchased.
It's digital Capitamonte.
And by the way, Diaspora did do something. I mean, I gave them, I think, $100. That was my first experience on Kickstarter. But now they've decided to move on. So I think that one's...
Well, they've thrown it open to
It's open source. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which
means it will die.
It's nothing. Some of this is cool stuff. I hope I get it. I did get the Joey bra. Exactly as promised.
Did you fund the Tesla Museum?
No, you know what? I'm a bad man. I think I did. I meant to.
Oh,
but they made
Indiegogo.
The money. They got the money.
Oh, was
right?
that Indiegogo? Sorry.
That was Indiegogo. And the problem with the Tesla Museum was that was just enough money to buy the land.
Right.
Now they need a lot more to build it. That seems to me yet another way to throw money away. I don't know. So what is...
It's now...
Is there going to be a backlash at some point on Kickstarter? I mean...
$1.2 million. So they got 400,000 extra, or
good.
350 extra.
Good. They could put up a little shack.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, the early days of even eBay or Craigslist or, you know, you go to buy something, you get ripped off. I mean, all of those entities have had to institute something, some kind of protection, even Airbnb to some extent.
Right.
You know, I think it's going to happen with Kickstarter. Someone's going to say...
But Matthew, I mean, I get... Yeah, but how can they really, right?
I don't know.
It's not an investment, but it's an investment.
Let the buyer beware.
Yeah, it really is. I think that you've got to... some of these ideas won't work, or there'll be problems with them. Or, yes, there'll be some people who run off to Brazil. But I don't know what Kickstarter can really do.
I think there'll be a big celebrated one. I mean, there have been a number of million-dollar-plus Kickstarters. Mm-hmm. All it takes is one of those for its recipients to go to Brazil, and then we're going to see a little Kickstarter collapse.
Yeah.
I've had a really good experience on Kickstarter. I've backed 16 projects. They have a new profile page if you go to kickstarter.com/profile/TeenagerPenny. And I think I had a bad experience with one. I mean, one that didn't happen. And the person emailed and said, this didn't happen. It took a lot longer than I thought it would. I got caught up with other things. What do you want me to do? Do you want me to donate your money to charity? Do you
Right.
want me to refund your money? And this was just a guy who was just a good guy. And I thought that not everyone's going to go through all that trouble. But I don't know. I think part of it is I think there's an art to like picking projects that are going to do well. I mean, I tend to choose projects that are pretty popular already. I'm pretty conservative, I guess.
Have you received all of these things?
Yeah, I mean, the first one that I backed was my cousin. My little cousin did a
home
album.
EP by Jenny O.
Jenny's album is great. It's out. It's in iTunes. And
see, that makes a lot of sense to me. And those are that's not a huge. Those aren't $1 million projects.
Right. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine wrote a book, the Mindfire book, Scott Birkin, who's great. And actually, you should have on Triangulation someday.
Oh, I like good. Scott Birkin. I would love to get him on. Yeah.
Yeah. Another one's an iPhone app for my friend does a website for Louisville Text Adventure. Zay Frank's The Show I backed, which is great. I mean, there are a lot of really good products. There's a new public market here in San Diego that got funded on Kickstarter, which I'm really excited about. They raised like $90,000. No, $146,000. So I don't know. This smart
yeah,
thing.
I've not gotten,
any,
I've not gotten anything that's just died on me. I've gotten some I haven't gotten yet, but they're still, that's okay. The timing is within their window.
I think about it more as creative charity than anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at it that way, then there's no loss.
But, the NPR example, is a open source, game box, I guess.
Booyah.
They've raised $8.5 million.
That's the one. That's the one that if they don't do it or they took off.
That's a little thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People are very excited about the Ouya. That's the most successful Kickstarter project of all time. I did not actually donate to that. I don't know why not. I am such a...
I mean, I think the things that Gina's talking about, or some of them, you know, you look at what Amanda Palmer did with her album and,
right.
and tour. That's a direct connection with a specific individual. Right?
Yeah.
An author, a musician, an artist, someone who's doing something that you want to support. Then there's a whole nother category that's, you know, basically companies making products. And I think in that case, if they just take the money and do something else, or then I think you have a right to complain. But I guess Kickstarter is saying, don't look for any help from us.
Yeah, I think a lot of these cases, these are not individuals, exactly as you say. These are companies that are already kind of in the business of kind of, you know, it just feels a little...
Well, what we're really going to get down to it is the Jobs Act. When they figure out exactly how to enforce it come January, when we can invest in companies, it is an investment and it is equity. But, you know, this is a hard business investing and people will make mistakes. I listened to a wonderful BBC, Peter Day is just a great guy on the BBC with a business show and a wonderful podcast I listen to all the time. And he did the British version, which has been out for a year now with tax benefits, by the way, to the investors. And what one of the services there proposes that you should do is make a bunch of small investments across a diversified portfolio of startups, just like a VC would, on the hopes that you hit okay on a couple of them, knowing you're going to lose on most of them.
Right.
But most people will never do that.
No.
And you still do better if you just bought index funds, no-load index funds, but all right.
Well, I'm struggling with this right now. I have one of my students... has a great business. I believe I believe a lot of my students' businesses, but there's one I was talking to today, I mean, who has been doing fundraising. She's got a great proposal. She's got a great business, I think, called Parceled, PARCELD.com. You can't find much about it there yet, but it's going to change the relationship brands to customers. Let's put it that way, right? So she's got all kinds. She's been out there doing a great presentation. She's been talking to the rich people. But it's trying to get that first domino to fall. Right, I've got another guy who's doing a really exciting business thing here in New York. Same thing. Talked to him today. He's got a great thing. He's been out there dealing with people, and it's waiting for that. If you find somebody to lead here, I'll come along there. It's an incredibly frustrating system for people, and it's we gotcha. And we can have this discussion about VCs and angel, but a lot of them can be really jerks, don't we know?
Yeah.
And that's what's holding up innovation. Now, of course, there's also a lot of really bad company ideas that don't deserve to be funded. But I think this is an area that is ripe for disruption. Is the Jobs Act the right way? No, it's not going to do everything. But I think that it brings in at least one more competitor to say, okay, the heck with you, I'm going to get funded my way.
I agree. I agree. And there's lots of neat Kickstarter stories. You know, Kickstarter responds to the NPR thing saying, since Kickstarter's launch in 2009, 30,000 projects have been successfully funded. That merely means they got money, by the way, successfully funded.
Yep.
By more than 2 million people, these projects include documentaries, albums, art, blah, blah, blah. The number of creative projects that have been funded and produced on Kickstarter in the past 3 years is enormous. Many could, but they never say how many delivered.
Do they even know?
I don't know if they know.
No.
They probably don't want to know.
Right.
Because that's a number they probably would not like to report.
But there have been other efforts that do really good analysis of the data that is available. But no one's done that follow-up study, which an academic really should do, as to what products actually got out. And then, you know, the next thing that's odd to me is, all right, so fine, there's products that I've seen on Kickstarter, I missed the time period, they're already funded, and I think, oh, I'd like that. There's no place to go buy it. Once the first tranche is delivered to the Kickstarter backers, is there an ongoing product there or not?
Kickstarter's terms of use require creators to fulfill all rewards of their project or refund any backer whose reward they do not or cannot fulfill. We do hope that backers will consider using this provision only in cases where they feel that a creator has not made a good faith effort to complete the project and fulfill. Kickstarter cannot refund the money because we never had it. Money's transferred directly from your credit card to the project creator's Amazon payments account. But I got to point out, Kickstarter takes a skim on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I mean, this is not a nonprofit.
You know, when I back a Kickstarter project, though, like, I feel like what I'm buying is being a part of something early on, like more than the product itself, like the TikTok, which was the iPod or the mini iPod mini watch band, you know, like I just saw that in the Apple store last week.
Right.
I bought that on Kickstarter. I was one of the first ones to have one of those. Yeah. It's in the Apple store now. It's pretty amazing. That was one of the really big projects.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, hey, like I was a part of this, or, you know, with the book or the albums, like I got a little thank you, you know, from the author or the creator. Like it feels more like just kind of being a part. I know I sound like a hippie right now and not an investor, but I feel part of a creative movement and part of a community of people who saw something interesting before anybody else saw that it was interesting. I can't wait to go to this new market in San Diego and be like, hey, I helped make this happen.
But you're the right person to be investing in Kickstarter because you have the right attitude towards it. I just fear that there's a lot of people who think they're in a marketplace of that they're buying stuff. Like, I think there's a lot of people who think they bought a Pebble watch that is going to be useful and wonderful. And A, there may never be a Pebble watch, or B, there may be one, and it's crap.
Yeah. Right.
And people, you have the right attitude, but I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but a lot of people who use Kickstarter are really think they're buying something.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the difference between the Kickstarters that are individually driven and the Kickstarters that appear to be companies. You know, if it's an individual and you're backing their dream and you buy into it, then you're willing to accept a little bit more risk, I think.
Yeah.
And maybe you're okay with feeling a part of it. If it's a company building a thing and they say they're going to build a bunch of them, then you want your thing.
Right. But I think that's a mistake to go to Kickstarter and see a thing. But I think that's what most people do. They say, oh, the Ouya is going to be great. I want to get in on the ground floor. Instead of Gina's point of view, which is those people have a great idea. I want to support them in their attempt to create this wonderful thing, whether they succeed or not, because that's really what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think most people, certainly I noticed this in myself, I really want that coffee filter and those gaming dice and the headset that makes the world 3D. I really want that thing. Big mistake.
Right.
I thought that's what I was doing, but I'm not.
Right. You're pre-purchasing.
I'm pre-purchasing.
Right. Yes.
It's not that. And does Kickstarter have an obligation to make that clearer or no?
I don't know if
that again goes to research. What do people think? This, I mean, if I were an academic, and I'm not, doing a study, I think it'd be a great study of funding. As you go to the Jobs Act, I would look at microloans and loan platforms that exist. I would look at Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and I would look at the jobs platforms that exist here in the UK, Jobs Act, I mean, and see what the delivery is and what the expectations are. What's the demand side say about it? It's a great area for study, I think.
I think it's in Kickstarter's interests, or Indiegogo or whoever, to just be as clear and repetitive as possible. Just to keep saying, this is between you and the person or thing you're funding. You know, we're just connecting you to, like, Craigslist or Airbnb or whatever. Yeah. You guys have to work it out.
I think you're right, Matthew, and I think that if there are those big bad cases that come out, there'll be regulation that comes. There'll be Chuck Schumer, my senator in New York, who loves the Saturday press conference.
Oh yeah,
will call one on Saturday saying, "I'm going to protect people by proposing a new law against these Kickstarter things,"
and that'll be a disaster.
Yes, yes. So it's in their interest to be as open as they can be. So maybe it is in their interest to know those numbers and to face them.
And maybe I'll get my dice someday.
And your coffee filter.
I think I'm going to get my Pebble.
I know we'll get a Pebble, but I want to underscore that I've seen a dozen of these things.
Yeah.
And they're horrible. They're unusable. And just be prepared.
Yeah.
Just be prepared. And it's not, you know, for instance, Kiva has gotten a lot of criticism. I think you understand what you're doing with Kiva, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear that these are micro lending, and you're probably not going to get your money back, but you might not. And if you do, you're not supposed to really take it out anyway. You're supposed to pay it forward and all that stuff. And I think you understand
Kiva's
what you're doing.
Example.
Kiva is clearly humanitarian, altruistic. Kickstarter feels like a marketplace, which is probably not what it should be billed as.
The ones that I find fascinating are the ones, like, I can't remember if this was a Kickstarter or not, but the bus monitor lady, you know, who got...
That's a great project, yes.
Yeah, who got belittled by the kids.
Yeah, the Reddit, the Redditors raised, you know...
$600,000. I mean, you
on
know,
Indiegogo.
I'm sure I wasn't...
That was Indiegogo?
Sure.
Okay.
Right. It was Indiegogo, sure, yeah, because it wouldn't... Kickstarter wouldn't... It doesn't...
Right.
It doesn't comply with their guidelines.
Yeah. 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 But I mean, you know, $600,000...
Isn't that
I'm not,
great?
I can't be the only person who thought, oh, I'll just film myself being humiliated some way. I'll get $500,000. I mean, she gets to do whatever she wants with that money.
Yeah.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Just find that fascinating.
Everybody's mad at me in the chat room because I'm bashing Kickstarter.
it's a Kickstarter funding platform. I mean, it's investor, not consumer buys. Well, you know, get over it. Plus, somebody said the dice look like two prostate glands anyway.
Not deliberately, I guess.
I feel that part of my job is to be a consumer watchdog. Now, the problem is that I talk to a variety of different levels. Anybody who watches this show is certainly more than aware of what they're getting involved with Kickstarter. But I'll also think about all the people who listen to the radio show who think that the internet is free via a thing called Linksys. And and it's for those people I fear. and Kickstarter rejected us because we asked we wanted to do a Kickstarter project for the studio and they said no.
Why?
I don't know.
Because it was part of an ongoing business?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, they have these specific guidelines. Like, their goal is for people to fund creative projects where there's something tangible that happens in the end, like an album or a documentary or a watch band or whatever.
Yeah, we probably should have gone to Indiegogo.
Yeah.
That's why I thought it was interesting. The I'm trying to remember the comic site. I can't remember the name
Oatmeal.
Of it now, but they did it. Sorry?
Oatmeal?
No.
XKCD? I don't know. I'm just throwing. I shouldn't. Go ahead.
No, another one. They did a campaign, and they were going to remove all the advertising from the site if they were fully funded.
Oh.
I'm going to find the name of it.
Did they do that on Kickstarter?
Penny Arcade? Wait.
Penny Arcade, yes.
Penny Arcade. Yes, awesome. And did they raise the money?
There was a lot of debate about whether they should be allowed to do that or not because it's part of an ongoing business. But their argument was, well, it's basically you're just buying a sort of ad-free version, so it's a specific thing. But I thought it was in a real gray area there.
And what was the final decision? Were they allowed to or not?
Yeah, they were. They said they'd talk to Kickstarter about it, and Kickstarter said it was fine.
It's called. It was the project was called Penny Arcade Sells Out. They raised $500,000 on August 15th. And it was just basically to support. See, I don't see how that's any different from asking people to help us build a studio, but I can see why there's debate. But I don't know. Who cares? I don't care. We did it ourselves.
Says the chat room. Well, now we know why you don't like Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's why.
But I actually got interested in the idea of using Kickstarter or something like it to crowdfund journalism. Could you... And I know there are a couple of journalism projects. There's a magazine that Bobby Johnson's involved in. There's a couple of other sort of one-off research projects. But could you use that model to fund, you know, like Dave Cohn tried to do with Spot.us? Is that a way that you could get your readers to support journalism?
I think that idea.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my students, if you look up Narratively...
Oh, yeah, they're on my list of things I backed.
Oh, they're getting close. They're at 41,000 with 50,000 gold, 4 days to go, folks. Look it up. Great people. A lot of people who write for the New York Times, New York Magazine, others really want to rethink how to do journalism in New York. I think their price is a little high, and they got to shove it in, but they could make it, man. They could make it if you'll help them.
Where is it?
They need $9,000.
Narratively.
Yeah, 4 days to go.
Yeah.
They're close.
Click it, Leo. Click it.
They're close. What do I get? Do I get a T-shirt?
No, I don't.
To feel good.
I get to feel good. See that one? They're not promising me any physical good. I can't complain, right? How can I complain? I just feel good because I gave. Hmm. Do I get a subscription? Oh yes, I'll be a premium member.
You can become a member of the inner circle.
Hey, I gave $100 to app.net. I mean, I'm an idiot. I certainly don't use me in any way.
Other than a bra.
A bra that doesn't fit.
The other thing I gave to on Indiegogo was Alexis Ohanian's internet promoting bus tour, which I think is a great thing.
Another good one. Yeah.
I didn't
there's good stuff. At least I didn't buy Facebook stock.
It's up today.
Is it up
today? Oh yeah.
Because
oh, yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg said he wouldn't sell, and they canceled their second
buyback. There are a million shares they're going to use to pay the taxes, which basically reduces the pool. So it's basically like a buyback. So it's up 4.8% today to 18.58. I think yesterday it was down to 17.8 or something.
I don't think you can get mad at Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg wrote a letter saying, hey, don't buy this stock. they effectively warned people that, hey, it's going to be a long time before we make any money.
Andrew Ross Sorkin wrote a really tough column in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Really tough, taking the CFO on and saying it was all his fault. And I think that that's Matthew ridiculous. Disagreed, but I think that it was not off the mark in the sense of saying that it's about the price that was set. They saw other companies like LinkedIn found the value went way up right after, so that meant that the company lost that money to speculators. So they wanted to price this to get as much revenue to the company as possible. The thing that nobody talks about here that I think really caused a lot of the problems for Facebook is that there was an artificial scarcity of the stock in a marketplace beforehand. The fact that you can trade insider shares now and there's a huge scarcity, nobody can get them, that drives the prices way up and it changes everybody's view of what the real value of the company is. And that's why we knew the valuation of Facebook was absurd before, but that was the valuation in an open marketplace, just a very scarce one.
Well, and Mark,
and there was a huge amount of hype. I mean, let's face it, everybody thought it was going to be a $100 billion stock. You know, all the brokerage firms wanted it. All the banks wanted it. VCs were, you know, desperate to get out at X price. I mean, that none of that is David Ebersman's fault. And if he accepts the advice of his underwriters about the listing price, you know, that is also not his fault. That's what they
but
do.
But ultimately, Matthew, the buck did stop with him.
But his duty was to raise as much money as possible for the company.
That's Mark Cuban's point. Mark Cuban said he did exactly what he was supposed to do. He got $10 billion bucks for Facebook. He says it was not Facebook's CFO's job to protect investors or to worry about shareholders' portfolio. True. If they were willing to pay that, it'd be foolish of him not to take it.
But what's the impact now on the problem is there is clearly an impact now on the company. You have people, you know, wanting Zuckerberg's head, which I think is way wrong. I sure wouldn't want the stock without Zuckerberg there.
That's a good point.
You have this it's the cootieization of the company now.
And Cuban's response to that, by the way, is that companies can reprice options. So unhappy employees can be made whole.
And you're right. I mean, Zuckerberg said, I am looking at this thing as a long term.
He warned everybody.
You know, so don't buy it if you want to flip it tomorrow. And so a bunch of people bought it so they could flip tomorrow. So they got screwed.
Yeah, somebody wrote an article saying it's obvious nobody read the prospectus or Mark Zuckerberg's letter. So it's not there. It's like buying stuff on Kickstarter. It's not your.
It's the RTFM tax.
Yeah, the RTFM tax. I like it. I like it. The Russian military, I like this story, has removed the Google layer from Android tablets because Google is spying on us all.
As opposed to the Russian
military.
But
that's
true. Right. The Russian Defense Ministry announced a stripped-down encrypted version of Android is destined for government and military devices. They'll also sell it to the public without Google's spyware.
Yeah, and nobody else is going to spy on you on that device. No.
I want it. It's called the Russian Mobile Operating System, Romos.
So wait, they're calling Google Maps spyware? Is that what's happening?
Because Google gets information about where you're going. Yeah.
Because Google spies on you, yes.
The first 10-inch tablets running Romos will be available later this year. Shockproof, waterproof, $460. Assembled in Russia.
It's like buying Soviet Army hats and pins and things.
I got those when I was in St. Petersburg. They were cheap. I bought a bunch of those.
Yeah, hammer they were and sickle. All legitimate.
Oh, you think they're not real?
Oh.
You mean somebody's like making those?
Yeah, because you could still get them today, years after. Supply is always there.
It says the finished product will be mainly aimed at state officials and military personnel.
Yeah, I actually am surprised that other governments don't do that. First of all, you can, because Android's open source, so you can make your own version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And why not? I think that's smart. I think our government should be doing that. Didn't they make President Obama ditch his BlackBerry and use some sort of crappy Windows Phone 6.5 device that had all this encryption hanging off of it? It's like this shoebox. didn't that happen? Am I wrong? 4 years ago?
I think so.
Yeah.
So. I misread the headline, and I thought it was they yanked Google Maps and called Google Maps spyware, like as if the Google Maps plane
is all of
hovering
it.
Over your house.
But they are,
the phone home capability.
The whole layer is gone. Yeah.
They're using their own GPS alternative called GLONASS.
But they've had that for a while. And in fact, my phone, the Samsung S3, and a lot of other phones support both GPS and GLONASS.
Do they?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because you can't sell it. You can't sell it in the Russian and other markets if you don't have GLONASS. And it's a second GPS system, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about Twitter with you, Matthew.
We need to have a therapy session.
Apparently, you both love it and hate it.
I do.
I am with you 100%. What do you hate about Twitter?
I guess I hate little things. You know, I hate the fact that their apps aren't consistent, so I can do some things on the iPhone app, but I can't do them on the iPad app, you know, and I can't do them on the website. I mean, those things are all infuriating, and I hate the fact that I'm addicted to it, and I'm just constantly on there and can't put it down. But I guess the bigger picture stuff is I'm concerned about where the company is going and where the service is going. And so as someone who's, you know, so attached to it, I'm concerned about where I'm being taken and whether I'm going to regret that at some point.
So it's the company you dislike?
I guess it's some of their strategy. I mean, I just don't know. You know, it feels to me as though they just want to control so much of the content, none of which they create, incidentally.
Right.
So, but they want to control as much as possible of that in order to try and monetize it. I mean, it was great when monetization wasn't a big deal. Then you just let content go wherever and it doesn't matter and people can create their own apps and that's great. But now, you know, the pressure is on. You've got to come up with, I mean, we talked about Facebook and its IPO. Twitter might have thought it was going to go public at a huge valuation before. I don't know if they're still thinking that now. So, but the pressure is on to generate cash that justifies the huge sort of private market value they have, and so they have to monetize it. So they're monetizing me and my attention and my content,
right.
And so they're controlling it, and that irritates me.
I like this part that you said that you hate that it's becoming more of a broadcast network than someplace where you actually talk to people. And I think that that's true. You know, after we talked about it a couple of shows ago, I actually did get verified by Twitter, which is wonderful. Thank you, Twitter. But when you get verified, it's interesting. Like, by default, if you go to my profile, you don't see any of my replies to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You only see tweets which are not replies, which I think says a lot of exactly what you're saying, that Twitter wants this to be kind of a place, a broadcast medium. And this is the thing I don't like about Twitter is that it all just feels like we're all just sort of standing on the top of mountains, like shouting out into the void about ourselves. It feels like, it also just feels sort of like this ego machine, but that it's really difficult to have good conversations. And I mean, my friends reply to one another a lot, but it's so difficult even with the client tools to just follow threads of conversations. I mean, that's why, you know, Storify is great, but you need to have somebody who cares enough about the conversation to actually compile the Storify, you know, to
keep
the conversation.
It would not be hard. It's a computer. It could figure that out.
Matthew,
theoretically.
True.
Yeah. And Matthew, haven't you talked about how what you think said with Twitter and other posts you've written is that it becomes a promotional vehicle for TV?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I wrote one post about how two things that Twitter did in quick succession really summed up for me the contrast and the tension and the sort of conflict between the two visions of what Twitter should be for. And one was shutting down Tumblr. Just, you know, you can't use our follower search tool anymore, period. The same thing they did to Instagram. So that's on the one side. The other side was bragging about how well the Olympics went because it drove a lot of traffic to NBC's prime time.
Right.
So, you know, you've got, here's what we don't want. We don't want you to be you, the user, to be able to do useful things with another platform that involves Twitter. So stop doing that. And on the other side, our friends at NBC just love us because we're pushing eyeballs to prime time. Well, that to me, you know, do I want to just be a vehicle that pushes eyeballs to prime time? I don't know. I don't think so.
Twitter has become Speaker's Corner, where a lot of crazy people get on boxes and shout.
Or it's become, let's go with metaphor here, it's become a street where barkers stand out of their stores and yeah. scream at you.
Mm-hmm.
So my big problem with Twitter now is related. Whenever I look at the at replies, there's so much garbage. People use it to shout at me.
That is also an interesting consequence of being verified. You get spammed way more, way more instantly.
Did you get a bunch more followers when you got verified too?
Because
I'm wondering if the spam bots then, you know.
No. You get added to, or you get followed by Twitter Verified. So I think that they're looking at Twitter Verified's follow list to see all the people who are verified. My followers actually stayed about the same rate of growth.
Good.
But you definitely get spammed a lot more, which
sucks. It means that it's hard to have conversations because it's become a shouting match.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, to some extent, that's a natural phenomenon given the size of the network. I mean, when lots of us started, it was very small.
Right.
And I think that's part of what people get out of, say, Google Plus or app.net is that it's a small network and it's people you know or in some cases know. And so it just feels smaller. I think the challenge for Twitter is they're getting big.
Right.
And that's great if you want to sell ads. But to some extent, it's degrading the user experience. And I don't think they're helping by threatening things like Tumblr and Instagram and maybe even Flipboard. You know, I just don't think that's, for me as a user, that's doesn't well,
that
feel
was
right.
I agree. That was the really interesting conversation that then proceeded after that, and you got quoted in it. Mike McHugh warning that he fears that if Twitter closes down too much too fast, it really loses what it is. And then Fred Wilson came back and answering kind of you both. Saying that trying to answer the question that you posed is, can you be a business and be an open network? And he said he thinks that you can, but the problem he argues for Twitter is that it started too open.
Right.
That it's easier to start close. It's like the old argument about pay. It's easier to pay and then give it away free than pay. Same, and I don't know that I buy this, but the argument here is that it's easier to be closed and then open up. But I don't know that
I
you ever
right,
do.
Though.
Witness Facebook.
But I think he's right. I think Facebook, it was easier for Facebook to do something like the open platform later after it had built this huge thing rather than start out wide open, which is what Twitter did, and then try to close down.
But I would argue, Matthew, but Twitter would never be Twitter if it hadn't been open.
Well, that was my argument too. I wrote a post today basically, you know, responding to Fred, looking at what he said. Twitter is trying to wind back the clock to sort of rewrite history and say, well, now we'd like to be the thing that we could have been if we weren't so open. But the reality is they never would have gotten to where they are now if they weren't open. That was what built the network. I mean, at replies and hashtags and retweets and everything that is unique about Twitter was created by users. They didn't come up with all that stuff. Do you know what I mean? So now they're trying to monetize that and control it, the reality is it wouldn't have existed if they hadn't been open in the first place.
And of course, the question Twitter is asking is, well, okay, fine. So let's pull up the ladder. Can they continue to maintain value or increase value? I mean, there's nothing. I understand that morally and ethically, it feels bad to be open and then close. But is it impractical? It's practical, isn't it? Aren't they going
to... Sure, it's practical. But so the big question that I don't know the answer to is, and I think we're finding out the answer, is when you try to wind back that clock and you try to close down or tighten down or however you want to describe it, shepherding the ecosystem, I think Jack Dorsey calls it, when you do that, can you maintain that value that you built by being open? Or do you sort of kill the goose that laid the golden egg by trying to restrict it too much?
Can we think of examples of open things that have closed and survived? Are there open source projects that became closed source? Are there...
That's tough to do.
I guess not.
It's almost impossible, I think.
It's almost impossible. Yeah, you'd have to go to every single contributor and have them agree to change the license of the code that they wrote.
You could fork a non-open version. Mm-hmm. But what about, okay, here's an example then, and I think I've used this before, CDDB, which was an open database that people contributed to of music information, which basically sold and became a proprietary system. It survived. In fact, it's probably very profitable right now. IMDb, same thing, right? It was originally created. All the data was created by users. And then it basically went to a commercial operation.
And no longer depended upon those users.
Right.
Right.
You could kind of argue that Wikipedia is, I mean, certainly still open, but it's way more difficult today to make a Wikipedia edit than it was 5 years ago, just because there's so many controls and so many, you know, the community is so vigilant now.
Delta F has sent me an article from TechCrunch saying that Oracle is basically trying to take MySQL closed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But I think they're going to have trouble doing that. I mean,
that's
Wikipedia,
tough.
I used it as an example in my Twitter post today. It's a little like Wikipedia, not just closing down or becoming more restrictive, but doing that in order to appeal to large brands and sell ads. I mean, that changes the whole nature of the experience.
But they've, yes, and that would be no longer Wikipedia, and it would absolutely damage them. But I don't think Twitter is in the same position as Wikipedia, or is
it? I don't know.
No.
I don't know.
I mean, it's clear that it's, you know, you got to dance with the one you brung you. It's unethical. It stinks. It's, you know, but will users really rebel? I don't think so.
Well, let me try this example on you. Movable Type.
They were open source.
They were open and open source.
Became
and
six
free
apart.
And all that. And then to make it into a business, right, which we understood, they had to create a licensing scheme. And you could do that well or do that badly. And I think that they didn't do that as well as they could have. And it had a permanent impact on the company and opened up the door for WordPress.
Two other examples.
WordPress is ingenious to me because and I use this example all the time. If you can maintain an open layer and become the first to build it on top of that, you will always benefit from it being open because others will contribute to it. And you reduce your costs and other things. And yes, you'll have competitors building, which is what Six Apart tried to prevent. That's why its licensing was onerous, because it tried to keep people from building a competitor to Six Apart's own hosted platform. And I think WordPress learned from that and said, no, okay, we'll create the open platform. We'll leave it open. And even when the VCs from Polaris called me about this, I only echoed what the founders wanted, I'm sure, when I said, no, leave it that way. That's genius. Build the for-profit on top of that. Be the first to know it. So you separate the two, whereas Six Apart ended up in channel conflict, in community conflict. So people said, why am I going to contribute to this anymore? And you're restricting my license horribly here, and I don't like this. At the same time, we knew it couldn't continue free forever, so we agreed, I think, as users, that they had to change the structure so that they could survive, because we wanted them to survive, because we depended upon them, because they were a platform. But it's a very tricky shift.
The two examples that I like to think of are Dig and MySpace. I mean, those were primarily communities, content-related communities, but not, you know, platforms, not sort of technology, not software. It was about the community. And Dig effectively ruined its community by trying to monetize in the wrong ways, by trying to, you know, answer to their VCs or whatever caused the problem. And MySpace arguably did the same thing, ruined the user experience in an attempt to try and monetize. I think those are the risks for Twitter. I'm not saying it's going to happen, just saying that's the risk.
Hmm. Yes. Dig is the poster child, and MySpace, the poster child for what not to do. The Democratic Party platform includes internet freedom and cybersecurity. I know sometimes those might be at odds. I don't know. The Democratic platform calls for an internet that is secure and reliable and is respectful of intellectual property. The free flow of information and privacy. Basically, it's everything anybody would ever want, and then some. Key provision in the Republican platform released last week was reducing regulations on broadband providers. I'm not saying I have a dog in this hunt, but, you know, there you go. Moving on. I don't want to get too political here. But I enjoy those speeches that YouTube blocked later.
On the political end, the story there about why campaign reporters are behind the curve is very long, but actually very good.
I liked it a lot.
Out of the book, mm-hmm. right? Arguing that reporters, and we know reporters doing the horse race stuff. It's just stupid and ridiculous and wasteful and brings nothing. And I've complained about 15,000 correspondents at each convention reporting on absolutely nothing because nothing happens. It's all scripted. It's all infomercial heavy on the commercial light on the info. Having said all that, even with all that as criticism, this piece argued by Sasha Eisenberg, right?
Yeah. Sasha Eisenberg says that it's worse than that.
Yes. That
the truth is we aren't even that good at covering the horse race.
No, there's very sophisticated data going on to figure out that small portion of the population that actually is movable and that they're looking at the campaign within the campaign in entirely different ways. And we're missing that story utterly.
It's basically like gaming dig.
Yes.
It turns out that the electoral college system is highly gameable. We know that because I live in a state where it doesn't matter who I vote for. It's done. So I could just ignore the polls because all of California's electoral votes will go to Obama no matter what I do. But there are a few states where it really matters, Ohio, Florida. And so those states, a lot of data is gathered about each individual in those states, much more detailed than one might imagine. It's not merely, you know, soccer moms or Latino voters. It's really deep. And they quote President Obama's chief pollster, Joel Benenson, who says, think of it as a level 5 player in chess. The press is a level 5 player in chess and a level 8 player in chess. You have people covering campaigns who are at the mercy of the grandmasters of politics. The journalists just don't understand the big data that's going on now in political campaigns. They miss the story completely.
And I think calling them level 5 is being complimentary.
Yes, I agree.
Breathless and often fact-free stories about data mining and micro-targeting soon became plentiful, but few journalists had access to any of the campaign's actual data or even much understanding of the statistical techniques they use. It's a really good article. I tried to explain it on the radio show and did a miserable job. But if you're worried about the targeting and the marketing and the tracking cookies that you see day to day, hey, this stuff is being applied in political campaigns to great effect. To great effect. And the campaigns are using it in, you know, they're playing it like a grandmaster. It's very interesting.
It is.
Sometimes, you know, I feel like these campaigns are moronic. And sometimes I feel like they're very smart. And I think they're both simultaneously.
Yeah. Or they treat us like morons.
They certainly think we're moronic.
Yeah.
But in the post car, well, you know, you're in Canada. I don't know. What is the Canadian take on the U.S. election, Matthew?
I must admit, I haven't been paying attention to it that much.
No, you're just like an American then.
But I haven't actually been. I've been following the convention chatter on Twitter. That's mainly the way I've been consuming the political news. So.
Yeah. Yeah, 140 characters. That'll give you all the depth and detail you really need.
Well, there's links in there too. You know, so
there are links.
Yeah,
I just feel like the two-party system, the electoral college, it just makes it ripe for gaming. And of course, all these computer tools that's what they're really good at. And you've got a whole generation of younger people, Gina's age now, in there who know how to pull all the levers, and they are doing it.
So much of it seems like theater to me.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely theater, and some of the actors are pretty bad. All right, we're going to take a break. Come back with your tips, your tools, your picks of the week, and Matthew Ingram. If you want to, you know, pick something or talk about something you like, you can do that too. But first, a word from our friends at Two Cows, the same folks who bring you Hover.com, which is that great domain name. system. Actually, you know what? I think two cows, and I talked to Elliot Noss, the CEO there, and I think what they've decided is, look, we're going to look for industries that are ripe for reinvention. Industries that are just run poorly that somebody who's smart and uses technology properly can transform. They started that with domain name registration and hover.com, and now they're doing it somewhere we really need it, in the cell phone industry, the mobile phone industry, with ting.com. When he showed me Ting the first time, I just was so impressed. I thought, this is exactly what it should be. Big savings, no long-term contracts, billing clarity, so you know what you're paying for and you get exactly what you're paying for without the penalties, and just complete usability. TING.com. It's built on the Sprint network, so if you have good Sprint coverage where you are, this is a very good choice. Just go to Ting.com and look at the plans, and you'll see how it works. At first, you might say, this is like, any cell phone carrier. You pick how many minutes and messages and data you want, and then how many phones you want. And this is kind of nice. You pay $6 per phone per month. So as many phones as you want, great for families or small businesses. So let's say we're going to have four phones, and I'm going to say, the four of us will share. These are all shared, 2,000 minutes, say 1,000 text messages and 3 gigs of data. And that will cost, for all four of us, $124 a month. But here's the beauty part. If you don't use 3 gigs of data, let's say you use two, they'll rebate you the $18 difference. Let's say instead of 1,000 text messages, you do 6,000. There's no penalty. They just charge you the difference. So you're paying for exactly what you get without penalties. You are credited or charged the difference based on actual usage. That's what you get billed. You always get for free voicemail, picture and video messaging, three-way calling, caller ID, tethering, and hotspotting. So this is that's all built in. They are not blocking you. Now, they've got a broad variety of devices. They even have ways you can bring your own devices. It's a little more complicated, so you got to, because it's a Sprint network. They do have the Galaxy S3, which is very nice, the Photon Q, and even feature phones. So, you can save. They also have, and this is really good, data devices. So you can use their 3G and 4G networks at the same affordable, straightforward pricing. I am really a fan. If you go to ting.com/twig, play with the online savings calculator, you'll save $50 on your phone. $50 right off the top. People, I want you to discover this, because this really is, this is the beginning of how I think using technology appropriately, modern billing systems and so forth, can really change the cell phone industry. Folks at Two Cows are doing it. Ting, another nice Canadian company. It's funny, they don't offer this in Canada yet. I think the system in Canada doesn't work that way. But Sprint, it's interesting. They're working with Sprint as an MVNO, and the Sprint is very interested and very supportive of what they're doing. No contracts. Ting.com/twig. I like this. Mom's ride free. If she uses her phone once a month, like my mom at the airport, you just get her a phone, like $6 for the phone, and her minutes and stuff you are pooled in with yours. So she uses it once a month. It's $6 a month. Bada bing, bada boom. I actually got to do that for my mom. I've been reading this for months, and I didn't even think of that. I love it. No overage penalties. You can use as much data as you want, by the way. And it's consistently linear billing. You get credits on light months. Multiple devices on one plan. Great for families and small businesses. No fees or limits on usage. It's just exactly what you see is what you get. WYSIWYG cell phone service. It's a revolution. Ting.com/twig. Save $50 on your phone. And thank you, Elliot Noss and Two Cows, for trying to make sense out of this crazy business. Gina Trapani, tip of the week.
Tip of the week. Google Spreadsheets added inline discussions per cell. So you can click on a cell. I don't know about you. I use the spreadsheets all the time. In fact, my co-founder and I are always making spreadsheets for our business. And now you could leave comments on a sheet before, but now on a particular cell, you can, if you right-click on it and choose insert comment, you can add comments, you can reply to comments, and you can even, like, at mention, or not at, plus mention someone, I should say, if you do plus their email address to give them.
That's sweet.
Yeah, so it's just
does
a
that share
thing.
The spreadsheet with them?
I think it's for people who the spreadsheet is already shared with.
Okay.
So you can, so they get a notification that they have a comment.
Right.
So yeah, just a little kind of upgrade, but I was excited about it because it's nice that you can kind of.
Oops.
She got disconnected right at the very last word of her tip. And now you're. We'll get her back. Your number of the week, Jeff Jarvis. It always happens that way.
Right. So. whenever that happens, I think it's my. I assume my connection's
right
now.
No, that was us.
No, you're still alive.
Sorry,
there she is. No, that's all right.
Skype crashed.
Skype crashed.
Skype couldn't handle the Google spreadsheets action.
It was too good of a tip.
It was too hot for Skype.
Yeah,
invaded.
Sorry about that.
So Royal Pingdom. The I don't know how big this survey is, but they looked at demographics of various social networks. Unfortunately, Google Plus is not included, and some of it, you know, obviously we're going to know. In terms of ages, 55% of Twitter users are 35 or older. 79% of LinkedIn users are 35 or older. Turning it around, 58% of Reddit users are 35 or under.
Yeah.
And so on, right? Orkut, 83% are under 35. Okay, so that's fine. So, but what fascinated me was the gender distribution. We still assume that the net and the geeks here on are male. But in the services they looked at, most of them are majority female.
Hmm.
Pinterest, Goodreads, Blogger, Tag, Tumblr, MySpace, Facebook, Twitter, WordPress.com, Yelp, Flickr, StumbleUpon, LinkedIn even, LiveJournal are all majority female. Majority male, Quora, Reddit, Orkut, GitHub, Stack Overflow, Hacker News, and Slashdot. None of those are a surprise.
Yeah.
So... this is not the domain of testosterone anymore.
Interesting.
Although,
or
you know,
should I say Pinteresting.
Pinteresting. Uh-huh. BuzzFeed just did that piece about app.net and Medium and Subtle being mostly white male.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I guess that those are kind of newer apps.
They're developers. Yeah. It's developers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Stack Overflow, Hacker News, and Slashdot, GitHub, Orkut, Reddit. Yeah. Deviant art is more female than males. That surprises me a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not much. The biggest one is Pinterest. That doesn't surprise me.
No.
Blogger is big female. Tumblr, big female. MySpace. I like this. It's interesting. And it makes sense. That's a ping royal.pingdom.com. PINGDOM. I hesitate to do this as my tool of the week, but I'm going to anyway, just to make people angry.
Oh, Leo's trolling.
I'm trolling. Have you ever used Bing on your Android phone? So it's funny because, and I actually, this kind of bugs me when Google does it too. You know, the Bing widget looks just like the Google widget, as if you could type something in this field, right? So it's got Bing and then it's got a field and then a microphone.
You can't?
You can't with Google either. You tap it and it just opens up the thing. So you could make the widget a lot smaller, gang. That's a lot of wasted white space up there. But it does have the voice thing, Gina Trapani. And it does a pretty good job. And I have to say, it is a very, very, see, nice interface. The official website, Wikipedia, Google+, Smarterware, Twitter. I mean, it does everything you'd expect it to do. It's got the pretty Bing pictures, images, videos, maps, local. This is a, you know what? If you want Windows Phone on your Android phone, just put this on here. And and you get all the benefits of Windows Phone, including Bing searches, Big Image search, and all of that stuff.
You know, that widget thing, that's an Android widget design thing. Like, when I was building a widget, it's so funny. There are all these
forums,
like, filled with questions. Like, how do I put a text input field in my Android widget? And the answer is you cannot. You cannot put text input fields in your Android widget. The ones that have them are just a launcher.
It's a lie. But the thing is, this could be a lot smaller because I don't, it just Actually, I have a resize thing. I wonder, let me see if this will, maybe I could just do it unofficially, resize it, make it. Oh, yeah, I could. There you go. That's okay. What it should there look like.
Yeah.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of those early web banner ads where it looked like there was something you could type into a field.
Right.
All they wanted you to do was click.
Yeah.
Yes.
Click. So, but, you know, Bing is free. You know, it's just one more thing.
So
you
can do whatever they want.
They can do whatever they want. I think it's kind of, I kind of like it. I just thought I'm going to be really, you know, counter. Instead of having the Google thing at the top of my Android phone, I have a Bing. Just why not? Give Microsoft some love, you know? They've been feeling lonely lately out there in space.
Bing.
Bing. That's very contrarian of me.
I love that.
But it's good. You know, it's a good. It's actually a very good search. It's got some nice features to it.
I use DuckDuckGo, so.
Yeah. They don't have a widget. Let's give DuckDuckGo some love. Matthew, you have anything, a pick, a tip, a number, anything you'd like to share with us?
Just one thing on what Gina mentioned about Google Spreadsheets. I saw that if you use if this, then that, you've heard of that.
Love IFT or whatever it is. Yeah.
So you can actually program things to insert stuff into a spreadsheet in Google Drive automatically.
Oh.
Yeah. O'Reilly wrote something about it today.
Wow.
Which I thought was really interesting.
That might be the most exciting thing that's happened to me all day.
You can use that because you know why? You know why Chad's so excited about that?
Pinboard works in with if this and that. And
right.
You so share your links
and
on
then
Pinboard.
You could populate the spreadsheet automatically.
Yeah. Literally, this made my day.
You
Thank
just
you so
gave
much.
Chad 8 hours more a day.
That is my
Because I want to be able to send you links throughout the week, Chad, that end up on the rundown. That'd be great.
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah.
All right, let's all coordinate.
Okay. There'll be an email coming out. Maybe I'll make a Google Doc about it, and then we can share some links to it. And then
you could, you could, for instance, monitor Jeff's Twitter feed, and if he put hashtag twig, then you would take that and put it into the spreadsheet.
Boom.
Right.
Oh,
boom.
Yeah.
Booyah.
Yeah.
Boom. As Matthew Ingram says of GigaOhm, senior writer at GigaOhm. Great to have you, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
Really love having you on the show. Are those boxing gloves on the door behind you?
They sure are, just in case things get,
a little heated in here.
Yeah.
Wow.
Those are for the editorial meeting.
I'm impressed. Nice to have you. Jeff Jarvis, City University of New York, buzzmachine.com. Great to have you. He's so quiet.
I was looking up. I just wanted to note here another number that the Glee premieres on September 13th. Be warned, fans.
With... Special guest star.
Ooh. Oh, I didn't hear about this.
I can't remember, but it was good.
Uh-oh.
Who's on Glee? I saw the promo for it, and I can't remember who it is now.
If you search Glee season premiere, I think you get the promo.
This is a bad sign because the chat room's not jumping in.
Well, Britney Spears is definitely going to... I think they're going to do a Britney episode.
They did that. They've done that before.
They did it before.
Is it Kate Hudson? I don't think that's it.
Just go to fox.com/glee. It has a video there. I don't know what it is.
I thought it was somebody more interesting than that.
I'm very
She's
cautious.
A dancer. She's a dancer. All right. Anyway. Kate Hudson.
Sorry.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
He's derailed the conversation, I gotta say.
I specialize in that. I delight in it.
You know, aren't they all like 40 years old now?
They're all like in college.
Yeah. They're in graduate cities. They're getting out of medical school.
They're too old to be teenagers. Gina Trapani is at... I like how she writes it in her Twitter bio. I think I got to go back to that now because I was looking at it and I thought, and by the way, where'd you get that great picture of you?
Oh,
that's cute.
Yeah. When Dark Knight Rises came out, this blog did like caricatures of tech bloggers.
As if you were
I
in.
I got to be. In a cape.
Yeah. She says, I make ThinkUp and todo.txt. Back in the day, I started Lifehacker and she's a superwoman.
She is.
Gina Trapani.
Nice cape.
Yeah. Nice cape.
Thanks. Thanks.
Love that.
Appreciate it.
We do this show every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time. 2000 UTC on twit.tv. You do watch live, because then you could be in the chat room and yell at me. And if you decide and if you decide not to watch live, well, you can also download the shows after the fact. We make on-demand audio and video available at twit.tv/twig, and you could yell at me then. But, you know, it was interesting because we were discussing yesterday, and the executive committee was meeting, and we were discussing, thinking about changing the theme song. And we came to the conclusion that however dopey our theme song is, it is our theme song.
It's true.
So we've somebody submitted a fun theme song, but I listened to it and I thought, it's just like every other theme song. We have a unique theme song. It's dopey. It's recorders.
But it's us.
But it's ours. So we're going to keep it. So there. Britney Spears in episode 2, episode 1, Kate Hudson.
Oh, it is Kate Hudson. Okay.
I didn't know she was a dancer, but apparently she is.
Sure.
Sure. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll see. It's a good promo. I should run it. We'll see you next week on Twig.